Welcome to episode 86 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interviewed Shiva Rajoy. I had a wonderful conversation, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. But before I do, this episode is sponsored by the Gateway Institute. They have two locations in California, Orange County, and the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as Phoenix, Arizona. They treat children, adolescents, and adults suffering with OCD and related disorders. They deliver therapy weekly and bi-weekly, as well as specializing in a three-week intensive outpatient program for OCD. Gateway is used to clients coming in from all over the US, as well as internationally, to take part in the three-week treatment program. If you're in one of those areas and are looking for treatment, head over to gatewayocd.com. That's gatewayocd.com. I'll also put a link on the OCD stories. And don't forget to say you heard it on the podcast. Now, my chat with Shiva was brilliant. I saw her TED Talk courtesy of Robin, who shared the TED Talk with me. It was all about kind of information and the age of anxiety, sort of information overload and how that can make us, I guess, nervous wrecks, you could say. Whether you have an anxiety disorder or not, you can see, you know, your friends who may not have anxiety disorder, but they're on their phones all the time and they have no attention span. They're never listening to you. They're constantly reading all drama that's going on in the world and in the news. And, you know, that's going to have an adverse effect on people if we don't start to use technology and information consciously. And we talk about that, and we talk about how kind of the answer to dealing with that is very similar to the answer to dealing with OCD. And we talk about Shiva's OCD story. She has OCD herself, how she manages it. And then I go through some of her Instagram posts, because each day or a lot of days a week, she'll put a picture on Instagram and put a big description explaining kind of a technique or insight. And we go over that. And we talk about sort of general lifestyle changes, gratitude. And I think you're going to love this. I think this is an interesting angle on OCD recovery. And she gives some wonderful advice, in my opinion, on the topic of recovery and living a good life. I personally really enjoyed this one, and I know you guys will too. So here's Shiva. So quick side note, guys, I noticed while editing there was some background echo of my voice. I'm not sure why this happens, so unfortunately I couldn't edit it out. So whenever I speak, you may hear an echo of my voice. When Shiva speaks, it's perfectly fine, and she does most of the talking, thankfully, on this episode, so you won't hear much from me in terms of background echo. But if you do, please accept it like you would an intrusive thought, and eventually your mind will just filter out my echo as it does with intrusive thoughts. So use this as an exercise, if you will. Enjoy. On the podcast today, I have Shiva Rajoy. Shiva is a psychotherapist at the OCD Center of Los Angeles. She specializes in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder and other related anxiety disorders. Shiva recently did a TED Talk called Addicted to the Answer, Anxiety in the Age of Information. Welcome to the podcast, Shiva.
Thank you so much, Stuart. I really appreciate you having me.
No, it's great to have you on. I have to thank Robin, who was the one who pointed me in your direction, or the direction of the TED Talk. So it was good. We'll get into it, and you talk about OCD, your own experiences, and from a therapist's point of view, how information is causing anxiety. And I respect that. It's something I've been passionate about. My background is, I'm retraining now into therapy. My background is in marketing, and being in marketing, and I did a master's in marketing, I'm fully aware of how marketers are trained to sell at whatever costs, and the media is exactly the same. And they're not necessarily bad people, because they're taught that there's nothing wrong with it. Maybe we'll get into that, but it'd be good to get your OCD story if you want to go into as much information as you want.
Sure thing. Yeah, happy to talk about that. So my OCD story and my therapy story, I would say it's easy to look back now and see some tendencies as a child. I can remember sort of specifically that it was very important that my stuffed animals were lined up correctly on my bed.
I had exactly the same thing.
Did you do that too?
I did, yeah. Well, something bad was going to happen.
That's exactly it. I was worried that if I left them on the floor, or if, you know, they were, I think I used to think about it as if they were dying or neglected on the floor, that something bad was going to happen. And I can always remember getting maybe like 20 or 30 feet away from the bedroom and going, no, I have to go back. You know, I didn't do it right. I have to go back. And that's the one that stands out to me because it was atypical. Of course, I didn't quite know it at the time. And then, you know, going into my teen years, it was just a lot of rumination, overanalysis. Again, didn't know, you know, felt that it was a bit different, but didn't quite know why. And then I talk a little bit about it in my talk, but it was really in college that I had, you know, I think it was under quite a bit of stress and my expectations of what college was going to be like and what that was going to mean for me weren't quite met. And I think that sort of triggered my first real experiences with what I now know to be pure obsessional OCD.
Yeah.
And at the time that was hypochondriasis, an episode of hypochondriasis, but it also touched on HOCD and ROCD. And I had no clue what was going on. As many of us don't, I think. I think it was super confusing and, you know, supposed to be the best time of your life. And here I am, you know, really struggling and really in my mind, you know, and that was difficult. And that actually took me to therapy. That helped me sort of seek out my first real experience with a really excellent counselor, Heather Demeter, who I met at the CAP Center at UCLA. And she was so wonderful. She really instilled sort of a love of therapy and counseling. And she showed me how much that could really, you know, change a person's life. But I would say the OCD elements were not addressed. And it took me from that point in time, gosh, I would say really another 5-6 years to understand what was going on for me. And I know we all have that kind of experience, or many of us have that experience of reading the article for the first time or reading the whatever it may be and going, that's me, you know, oh my gosh, that's me. And I can remember reading, I believe it was an article on ROCD at the time and going, wow, you know, that is exactly what I'm feeling. And that then started off a real journey of healing and understanding and then my work at the OCD Center of Los Angeles. So really blessed to have found the right diagnosis, because I know many of us go years and years without knowing. And that's so much of I think such a big part of the pain is not knowing what's going on. So for me, at least, that was quite a huge relief.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And thank you for sharing. I agree. I think the first step in recovery is that kind of I'm not the only one feeling. And it often comes nowadays from reading an article on the internet.
Yeah. sometimes the answers on the internet are what we need, right?
Yeah. I guess that brings us to your talk. Actually, one last thing on your story. So on your recovery, and obviously recovery, I'm guessing it's still an ongoing process for you. But at least at the start, what really helped you? I'm guessing exposure and response prevention therapy, but were there any other kind of lifestyle changes you made as well?
Gosh, that's a great question. You know, in terms of lifestyle changes, I think that this is kind of a funny one. I had always felt, like a bit more of a sensitive person, in the sense that I needed my sleep, I needed my exercise, my alone time. And I used to feel quite sort of precious about those and judgmental, I think, of my need to have such equilibrium. But one of the things that was very cool that I hope all of you know, my clients, and hopefully I can bring this to your listeners, can feel like they can give themselves permission to do, is to take what they need in terms of their lifestyle. And I do believe with all the energy it takes for us to manage anxiety, we might need a little bit more. If that's a little bit more sleep, a little bit more solitude, a little bit more of whatever fuels us. To me, I think giving myself permission to do that was huge. Of course, in addition to just understanding, restructuring, mindfulness was huge for me. And then, yeah, exposure and response prevention. But I, you know, I take my naps and I take them and I love them and I need them sometimes just to kind of keep myself above water.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And sleep's so, funny enough, I noticed this morning. So my wife has been working. She's had to work sort of 7 days straight because they've got like an event coming up. And she's had depression in the past and a little bit of anxiety now. Where she hasn't been sleeping a lot recently, she's been kind of a nightmare and then to live with. She doesn't mind me saying. And then last night she got about 10 hours sleep. She woke up this morning, and I've never seen her in such a good mood. And I think for some people, they just need to find out what that is. And obviously for my wife, she just needs to sleep a lot more than she has been. And it can make a world of difference to her mental well-being.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's almost seen sort of in our society sometimes as a, you know, we can perceive it as a weakness. And I think it's so imperative to, you know, what we call recovery, which is really more like remission or management. But I think it is so essential to take care of your physiology. It's such a key component, I think, to your long-term strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so in your TED Talk, you talk about information, how the abundance of it can be a bad thing. And I agree, you know, you just being on the London Underground or anywhere else, obviously in LA, I'm sure people are just glued to their phones at all time. And there's various stats that have come out. It's something like within 7 minutes of waking, like 90% of the people, 87% have picked up their phone. I know, for example, again, picking on my wife, the first thing she seems to do in the morning is go to The Guardian, which is one of the better newspapers in the UK, but you're still reading, you know, terrorism, murders. You don't really need that in your consciousness as the first thing you wake in the morning. So all of that, those types of things must play on people's psyche. So one of the quotes I picked out was, you talk about the more access to information, the more consumption there is of it, and then the more anxiety because of that consumption. I'm just wondering if you could explain why that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I think that the talk really sort of came about because of my work with my clients, and sort of my own recovery process, and seeing how important it really was to tolerate not knowing. You know, that is such a key component to, again, the management of an anxiety disorder. And I kind of looked around and I went, wow, well, you know, we are all getting so much more anxious. You know, we're all getting so much more agitated and anxious, and we're seeing this huge rise in anxiety disorders. And I asked myself why. You know, that was really sort of the impetus of the talk, as I said, why and what can we do about it? And one of the sort of the directions this talk took exactly was to sort of look at how information and answers have become so available and ubiquitous. There was an incredible statistic that I didn't end up putting in the talk because it was a bit confusing, but it was that we have access to more information in 3 days today than we did from the sort of dawn of humankind until the year 2013. I mean, you know, it's hard to explain sort of stage, but yeah, that one blew my mind. And to think about how, you know, we have this access, we of course will go and use it. We're going to use this great tool that we have now as a civilization. But the problem with that, of course, is that we get used to getting answers. We get used to getting them quickly. We get used to getting a lot of them. And I think that that doesn't help us in this sort of tolerance. It doesn't help us develop the tolerance for the unknown that I think is imperative to being a mentally healthy individual, to being able to really tolerate these big questions in life that, you know, sometimes the internet just can't answer. You know, the internet can't tell you if you're with the right person. You know, the internet can't tell you if you're gay or if you're straight or if you're on the right path in life. And I think if we are training ourselves to seek answers, to expect answers, and to feel very relieved by that, we're really setting ourselves up for some big disappointments as a society.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I read on one of your Instagram posts, you said you love evolutionary psychology or biology. I completely agree. I'm fascinated by who we are today, how being sort of a caveman potentially influenced our behavior now. And thinking of when you were just talking, it's like uncertainty was everywhere. We had to be uncertain, you know. If we go back real prehistoric, when we were just around a fire in a loincloth, and you know, a tiger could pop out any moment, and we had to hunt for our food, we didn't know where it was coming from. that's an unbelievably uncertain world, but we probably dealt with that uncertainty. Like, if you took us now and put us back then, we'd probably be dead within an hour because our brains would explode. But, like, I think as humans, we are designed to accept uncertainty because life is uncertain by its very nature. But I guess, yeah, the information overload is giving us the option not to have uncertainty anymore, which is a dangerous thing.
I absolutely agree. I so agree, Stuart. And I think, you know, it's, again, another connection I made in the talk that I think I could even make more explicit is, you know, you look at other big human evolutionary achievements or sort of societal achievements, like the abundance of food. You know, you look at when the agricultural revolution basically started and we started to have food. You know, that's fantastic. That was wonderful. It made lives so much easier for so many people. But at the same time, we overdid it because our biology hadn't fundamentally changed. You know, and here we are with a lot of food, or, you know, fast forward even hundreds of years, a lot of sugar, a lot of access to sugar, high fatty foods. Some, you know, we haven't changed fundamentally. And so we're consuming at such a higher rate than we need to. And that ends up backfiring on us. And I think that very similarly, that this phenomenon is happening with information, that we have spent, you know, thousands of years without it and exactly done quite fine. I would even go as far as to say, you know, the unknown spawns its own sort of beautiful directions and discoveries. And that's a whole nother direction we could talk about. But I believe just like with food and dieting, we're going to have to learn how to manage and sort of almost, gosh, information diet. Because there's such an over abundance of it now, we're going to have to be a bit more conscious.
Yeah, I completely agree. I got a question later on, actually, which we'll go on to that. So you talk about kind of to escape it and it being uncertainty, we must tolerate it. I just wondered if you could explain that concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I certainly wouldn't say to escape it, we must tolerate it. I think to make peace with it, to find, gosh, I guess relief would be the word, but, you know, we hesitate to use that one too too generously with OCD. But I think that the idea is, you know, when we escape, we reinforce the idea that we can't, right? So when you think about a compulsion, it's all about the idea of, we're one, reinforcing the message that we're being given by the anxiety, and two, we're reinforcing our intolerance. And that's sort of what I mean when I say that, you know, our relationship to the unknown, it's like a muscle we need to build up. Yeah. And it's not that we can quite ever escape it. It's part of the human experience, but I think we can get a lot more peaceful and productive in the face of the unknown, not so scared.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Okay, so the next point is a little bit of advice needed for me and any listeners that want to do this, that wants to go on, say, an information diet or wants to use information instead of information using them. And you make the point in your talk about when we learn to respect the benefits of information as well as the consequences of information. Because I don't think most people look at information, they think it's just benefits or it's neutral, but actually information can have negative consequences. When we learn to use or respect both of those, we can use it to our advantage. So I guess my long-winded question is kind of any advice for kind of taming information and learning to curate it so it empowers you?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think that I'm going to take a little leaf out of some of the work we do with individuals suffering from excoriation disorder, dermatillomania, trichotillomania. Yeah. There's some great strategies about riding the wave of anxiety, tolerating urges, you know, and sort of watching urges crest and then fall, and how empowering that can be for the individual, again, to know that they can ride that wave and, you know, kind of come out the other end. And again, it's so difficult because the responsiveness of our devices make this practice, again, quite difficult. But when we have a question, for example, when you're wondering about something in history, let's just say you want to know who the, you know, 24th president was, for example, you know, sitting there and being able to take a moment, you know, use our own faculties, tolerate the not knowing, practice, again, what we've done for sort of generations upon generations, having conversations, and you know, maybe give it a shot. Give it a shot and see if you can think about it and sit with it and wonder before then turning to your devices. You know, and another example would be, again, to really understand that although we have a lot of information, it is limited. That at the end of the day, there really are going to be questions that we don't have answers to. And that unless you're, you know, it's really a conversation with yourself, but no one online can answer certain questions for us. Nothing online can do that. And so coming to terms with that, I think, and being aware of that, you know, the possibility that you're going to be faced with a tough question and you might have to just deal with it yourself. That, I think, that awareness can make us a little bit less reliant. That can hopefully create some distance where it's not the first thing we go to.
Yeah. I completely agree. The whole kind of sitting with it until the urge dissipates. I think maybe that's a good practice, like learning to do that with, obviously not if it's an OCD thing, but it could be anything else that you're just curious about. Learning to sit with that urge and watch it kind of vanish is good practice for when you get an OCD thought. You have to sit with it and let it vanish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something I did several years ago, I still do now, is I don't watch the news, I don't read newspapers. And some people have called me like, not directly, but like, it's ignorant not to watch the news or read newspapers. And my take on it is, unless I'm going to do something with that news, it's pointless information to me. And frankly, the news only reports a fraction of all the awful things in the world. So it's like, even if you watch the news, you're still misinformed about 99% of things that are going on. So my take was, I'd rather not have it in my life and be happy than read about all these awful things. And also judge people, because instantly if I'm hearing about, I don't want to pick on any particular religion, race, or, but if I'm hearing about a religion ongoing, even if I'm unbiased, eventually that's probably going to seep into my unconscious and change my behavior towards that person or my beliefs. And obviously I don't want that. So I made a conscious choice to block the news. And obviously it's a person. Yeah.
See, I think that's so fascinating, Stuart, and I believe we're going to see more and more choices like that as people get, you know, and especially, of course, within the current news cycle. You know, I think it's so front and center in America. You know, I know worldwide, but we're certainly we're suffering over here in terms of our news cycle. There's a lot going on. And I think, and in fact, I hope that we're going to see more and more individuals making these kinds of conscious choices in terms of their relationship to information. And hopefully, because I agree with you, I've experienced the same, you know, as I've kind of experimented with my own relationship with news, trying maybe not to be as informed. I feel the judgment. And I definitely, I'm not 100% on where I stand. I don't have my strategy down yet. But I think, again, to take it back to food, I mean, people have plenty of different ways to have a relationship with food and a relationship with, you know, what they might consider an indulgence. And I wonder, and again, I hope that we're going to start refining our relationship to information and refining our outlook on it as we move forward. I think we're going to have to.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's just, it's spiraling now. Damon Horowitz, who's a philosopher, I think at the time was hired by Google, because Google have one of their core values is do no evil or do no harm, which is obviously a key value of most therapists. And he talks about, we're building all this technology, but no one's ever asking the question, what does this mean to the consumer? Like, for example, we built Facebook, but we never asked, what's this going to do to people's attention, to their happiness when they're comparing themselves? And you could argue in a capitalistic world, that's not the place of a corporation to question. But me being an idealist, I like to think it is. So yeah, hopefully that comes into play more. Even if the individual doesn't, the corporations will take more responsibility.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, Stuart.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'll keep hopeful. Okay, so kind of we talked about this earlier, but you said it in a different way, and I liked how you said this in your TED talk. You said, not having the answer can be the greatest solution of all. I think you ended on that, or it was towards the end. So I guess more advice around how to live with that open question, especially around, you know, intrusive thoughts. I need to do the compulsion or reassurance seek, whatever it is, to prove that I'm not a bad person, to prove that this isn't contaminated. I guess, how do we live with that uncertainty?
Yeah. I mean, I think first off, you know, personally admitting that it's an ongoing practice for me, even as somebody who works with clients, you know, for hours a day doing this work, I'm always reminding myself to try to accept and tolerate the unknown. Gosh, I have so many thoughts on this, and I know there's so many ways to look at it. I think I'd like to sort of start by highlighting a few things that I think are just so important. One being the word tolerance, that I think that, you know, we don't have to love the unknown. We don't have to completely, you know, it's not about changing our feelings of our sensitivity to its pain. That's not what it's about. It's really about recognizing that we can't do anything about it. Having that sort of, I sometimes call it a mature or sort of a stance towards the unknown that is, I can't change you. And I must accept you. And that doesn't have to be love. It certainly shouldn't be hate, right? But that it's sort of an acceptance, tolerance. And the word tolerance, I think, is so important to the unknown. I think the other big piece of the unknown that always fascinates me and I love bringing in with clients is recognizing how counterintuitive it is to our instincts. That when we are faced with pain, when we are faced with difficulty, our instinct is to fight or to flight, to run or to attack. And that really what we're asking our clients to do and what I'm asking myself to do, you know, every day, every week, is to do something that's very unnatural, which is in the face of pain, in the face of unknowing, you know, can you, instead of attacking, fighting, hating, running, solving, you know, can you do nothing? And I think that, again, I go back to that being such a practice, Stuart, because that is not what we do naturally in almost any other area of our life. And it's certainly not what the, you know, the quality that got our ancestors here today, that wasn't it. So it's just fascinating to see that as we've developed and we've developed these great brains, how the fight or flight mechanism, it's not really working for us in terms of mental health. We can't run so far from the things in our mind. We have to develop a different strategy, you know, and I think it does go back to that very counterintuitive experience of acceptance of pain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably the hardest thing I had to learn, as I'm sure with most people. It's, you know, we spend years fighting it when actually the answer all along was just to accept it and to feel the pain of anxiety, to the uncomfortableness of it. And when we allow it to be there without pushing it away or running, it will go by itself eventually. It's kind of like, I remember my mom used to say to me when my brother was picking on me, she'd say, just ignore him and it'll go away. And of course I didn't listen to her because I was like, he's not going to go away. That's a stupid thing to say. I didn't think in those terms. I was young, but so what I did was I kept resisting him, I kept fighting him, and he obviously kept coming back stronger and stronger. When eventually, when I finally learned the lesson of just ignore him, and it gets more intense, because he realized I wasn't reacting, but eventually he realized I wasn't going to react, and he left me alone. And it's the same with anxiety. It's not comfortable, when you've got to take the risk that this bully, is going to keep on at you, but eventually it's going to keep screaming, but eventually it realizes you're not rising and it will go. And it's easier said than done, but I've done it, you've done it, it is possible.
It is, it really, really is. And, you know, here's something, and I'd love to know, Stuart, if you agree with this. It's still hard for me to sort of say this and swallow this pill, but I really do believe OCD is an incredible teacher. And again, it's even hard for me to say that sometimes because, of course, we can all understand how painful it is, how difficult it is and how debilitating it can be. But I think it can be a very incredible teacher in the sense that we do learn these tools of tolerance, these tools of, hey, maybe instead of pushing and fighting and hating and resisting, can I try a different strategy? One that doesn't seem, you know, it doesn't seem like the answer. Sometimes it feels like you're giving in or giving up.
Yeah.
But kind of finding a way through that doesn't feel intuitive. And I think it makes us flexible, and it forces us, I think, to look at pain and discomfort with these fresh eyes. And I found, and again, I'd love to know your experience with this, but I found that that's generalized to a lot of other areas of my life that don't really have to do with OCD, but have to do with pain and discomfort and struggle. And I'm like, oh, I have this new technique or this, you know, alternate way to deal with pain in my life. And that's thanks to my experience with this disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some people get funny about like silver linings type attitude. But for me, it's like if I don't find a silver lining, I've suffered for no reason. So that's just my personal opinion. So being an optimist. There's a couple of things. One is like every great person, and by great, I mean they could be caring. Maybe they could be a high achiever, they're sensitive, they're interesting to talk to. When you get into their background, or every single one of them has suffered, and they've allowed that suffering to make them the incredible human being they are now. And I believe like the pain is the greatest teacher, and we don't always want pain, but it's so important. Yeah, and then the other thing was Stephen Hayes, who I had on the podcast in episode 4, I think. He was one of the earliest guests, and he said something which at the time I thought was quite like, what's the word? I don't know, I thought it would get more people like criticizing him for it, but no one said anything, so maybe it resonates with people. But he said, if you've had a mental disability or disorder, you're the lucky ones. And I remember, okay, Lance Armstrong's not to say the great role model anymore he once was, but in his book, It's Not About the Bike, he writes, a cancer sufferer writes to him and says, we're the lucky ones. And he partly meant because they survived the cancer, but he also meant because they finally see how precious life is and they get to live the rest of their life, you know, actually appreciating it. And I think it's similar in the case of OCD, it forces you to grow, it forces you to learn, as you said, become more flexible, learn these skills, learn mindfulness, learn tolerance, learn to live with uncertainty. So now, like you said, when other areas of my life that aren't sort of anxiety or OCD related, when they come up, I deal with it better. Like a death in the family doesn't knock me for six. I'm absolutely like, I'm not fine. That was completely the wrong thing to say. But like, I accept it. I know how to grieve. I know how to move on and accept as part of life, etc. And anything else that comes up, you know, if I were to get made redundant tomorrow, it would be tough. But I know I would have the resilience there to find a way. And they're all things, all skills I've learned. So it's, yeah. And I think that's what Stephen Hayes meant. He said, when you finally get a grip on your disorder, the skills you've learned will amplify every other area of your life and you'll be a happier, more better person for it.
That is so cool. I love that. And it's so interesting that, you know, I think both of us, and I think, you know, we have a little bit of a reaction to the silver lining, to sort of espousing that silver lining. And I think it in no way should negate how difficult it is to be, especially in the thick of the disorder and to be, you know, working through it. It is incredibly painful. But I'm with you. I think that it's incredible for me to be able to say it, but to look back and just go, I think it's made me a better person. You know, I think it's made me a better partner, a better friend, a better human. And that's crazy because there's days when you just hate it so much, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I am who I am today to some degree because of that part of my life. And would I change it? Yeah, probably. But I can't. So I'm going to be appreciative for what I have today. Okay, so you talk about Halts, H-A-L-T-S, on your Instagram. And I like this, and I wanted an acronym and see what it stands for and B, why it's important.
Absolutely. So, just to fill your listeners in, I have a professional Instagram. It's called The Shrink Wrap. And it just sort of talks a little bit. It's mostly focused on OCD and anxiety, and there's sort of strategies in there. And one of the things I talk about on the Instagram is halts. So we borrowed this from AA. I believe AA uses halt. I think I added the S, but we made it halts. And so what that is that's an acronym that basically can indicate times when you're going to be more emotionally vulnerable. And those times of emotional vulnerability can be trigger points for us. We're a little bit less, we are a little bit less equipped during those times. And I think it can be helpful to be aware. So HALTS, H stands for hungry. We can all be a little bit more prone to reactivity when we're hungry. The A is angry. The L is lonely. The T is tired. And the S is stressed. And when I sort of read this and introduce this to clients, a lot of them go, I'm 3 out of 5 of those or 3 out of 6 of those all the time. You know, we kind of laugh. And I tell this story about how if I lose, and this is similar to how you're talking about your wife, Stuart, but if I lose even an hour of sleep sometimes, I am so much more prone to intrusive thinking the next day. And it's incredible to me to see how important, you know, equilibrium can be to us. And one of the things I ask clients if they come in, an individual comes in and they say, I've had a rough week. Right before I ask about the details of it, I go, tell me a little bit about what the week felt like in general. Where was your sleep? You know, were you taking care of yourself? Were you nourishing yourself? Did you get in a fight with your partner or your parents? I like to see what the environment around the client looks like, because so often that to me can help frame the intrusion, the intrusive thought, the spike.
That's an interesting way to look at it. And for example, like for me, the H and the A go together quite often. Because when I'm hungry, I can get angry or irritated or snappy. It's interesting to see how they can kind of work. And obviously, stress feeds into anger. And I guess anger could then lead into loneliness. If you're angry, you might push people away. I think lifestyle choices are important. And obviously, when you're in the thick of OCD, it can be hard to look after yourself and maybe think, what's the point in focusing on my sleep, on focusing on diet, etc., or stress levels. But actually, it's those things that are going to amplify the symptoms. And it's good to see more therapists focusing on that stuff as well.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I just want to speak to that because I think that's so fascinating, such a fascinating part of OCD treatment, Stuart, when you talk about kind of feeling one way and acting another. You know, feeling, like you said, in the thick of it, probably you don't want to get up and take care of yourself, or you don't want to, you know, stop being angry in that moment. And like you said, it might not be the most intuitive step to take care of yourself. But one of the things about behavioral therapy, sometimes I call it fake it till you make it therapy, because, you know, like you said, just acting in those ways can really influence those thoughts and feelings. And, you know, anybody who's done OCD treatment can sort of see that there really is that that component of recovery that asks you to put aside your thoughts and your feelings, or rather sort of put them in on the side for just a moment while you act in a way that doesn't reinforce them. And I think it's difficult for individuals to wrap their head around that. It was very difficult for me, but it is so key to be able to almost act without feeling like it's, you know, easy or the best thing to do, or even right in the case of some of the Pierrot type thoughts. And that always fascinates me, how we almost have to split in a way and have that behavioral pull.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, fake it till you make it, I think it's a good way of looking at it. I always say it's kind of like we need a heavy dose of faith in OCD recovery and exposure. And when I say faith, I don't mean a religious context. Obviously, that can help. But I mean just the general term of the word faith. Like doing exposure, it's you're having faith that the bad thing won't happen. And I think the more we can build up the skill of faith, because I think it can be a skill, it's something we can nurture. We can learn to leap off chasms, metaphorical chasms, not literal ones. Because deep down we know from history that there will be another plateau we can jump onto.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you talk in the Instagram, and again, I was going to say to anyone listening to check out your Instagram, because I think the way you do a picture and then you put a good chunk of text underneath explaining it, and I think that's really good. So these next couple of questions are also from your Instagram. So you talk about gratitude practices, and you asked your followers, you know, what were theirs, and I wanted to get what yours are.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, you know, I love the practice of gratitude because, again, I sort of wrote about this in the post, but I think it can be OCD, having OCD can sort of color a world, and it tends to be, OCD is a bit of a pessimist, I guess we could say that.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it can be so energizing and refreshing to sort of contemplate what is good in any moment. What I do is I actually have my use of technology, I have a Siri reminder every single day. Siri reminds me around 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock when I tend to dip a little bit, my energy levels get low. There's just a reminder on my phone and I use, it says gratitude, and it reminds me to stop wherever I am, take just, you know, 15 seconds. It doesn't have to be very long, and allow that moment, you know, in that moment for me to look around and go, what am I grateful for right now? And this doesn't need to negate what we're struggling with. It's in addition to, it's, you know, you can have your life and your struggles, but there's usually something to be grateful for in that moment. And I find that it brings quite a bit of balance to what often ends up being, you know, a bit of a negative story, a negative radio in our thought process. So that's how I do it. I use Siri.
That's good. That's we're using technology to benefit you, right? I really like that, and I might try that out for a week and see if that works for me. But yeah, I agree. It's just about directing your attention and, you know, using Siri as a reminder just to pause and where is my head right now and can I refocus it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's really good. Okay, and in one of your other Insta posts, you talk, you say The Happiness Trap is one of your favorite books.
Yeah.
And it was the first book I ever read actually on ACT. And at the time, I didn't know it was ACT. And you say you recommend it to your clients. I just wanted to get your take on why it's your favorite and why you recommend it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I love this. Is The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris. And I use it with almost all my clients. Again, it's one of the ones I really recommend. It was a big game changer for me when I read it as well. And, you know, it's not OCD specific. A lot of the reading, you know, we do is OCD specific, or the work of Lee Bayer, for example. Great work, a bit more OCD specific. This Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, and then this book that Russ Harris has written, I love, because it's more about how to face discomfort and challenge in one's life and how to restructure our expectations around happiness.
Yeah.
That, you know, by searching for happiness, we're resisting what is, and that's a conundrum in and of itself, that it creates more unhappiness. Mm. In addition to that sort of main theory that runs throughout the book, Russ Harris, he's got some really fantastic tools in this book that I've adapted to use in therapy. You know, some of these kind of diffusion techniques that he uses, your listeners might be familiar with them, but, you know, taking an intrusive thought and playing with it, you know, having this almost cavalier attitude towards the intrusive thought, where you can say it with an accent or sing it, you know, or imagine it on a t-shirt that's stretched out, you know, so you can kind of make this thought that's so painful and seems so real, you can knock it around a little bit, you know? And I think that certainly the first time I read it was quite revolutionary for me to think that, oh, I don't have to look at these thoughts with such gravitas, right? That they're just thoughts, you know? And when you play with them like that and you knock them around a little bit and you kind of, you know, you don't let them take up so much space, they do really, they lose power.
Yeah.
And so go on. I was going to say, I just really adore this book. I really do. And I recommend it to clients, and I recommend it to friends and family members. And so this is not OCD specific. This is a great read, I think, for anybody who's up against something in life, you know, and kind of looking for some peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd even say like it's something that should be read by all like 16-year-olds before they leave school. Just so, because we never get taught at school how to, just the basics of thoughts aren't facts, they're just clouds. And just that simple practice and some skills would save so many people heartache and pain, unnecessary heartache and pain, I should say. Because I guess without a certain amount of heartache and pain, we'd never know what joy is either. So we need it there to an extent. I love the book. I think it's great. I've tried to get him on the podcast as well, but he doesn't answer my emails.
Come on, Russ.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So generic questions now. So what is the one thing people with OCD should start doing?
That's a great one. You know, where I see really huge shifts in my clients' sort of management strategies comes with that idea that we talked about a bit earlier of not fighting. I think that it is, you know, I sort of say sometimes the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And that if you're hating something, if you're, you know, fighting and hating and, you know, oh gosh, there's OCD again, or oh my God, now it's going to ruin this moment. And, you know, when we give OCD that energy, it's quite powerful. And I think to think about the opposite of love as not hate, but indifference is, again, sometimes people can perceive that as giving up or giving in, you know, and it is in a way, but in a very powerful way. It's sort of giving up to get, you know, giving up to get peace. And I think that seems to be quite a big turning point for many, many of my clients, is that when they realize that they are hating and fighting and resisting, and when they can flip that to accepting, naturally we're going to put less energy into our anxiety. When it has less energy, less fodder, it becomes less powerful. And again, I think that relies on taking that leap of faith that you talk about. I think we're so afraid that if we stop, you know, holding it back and pushing against it, that maybe it'll engulf us. Maybe it'll take over. But it really takes that moment of extreme bravery and that leap of faith to go, you know what? I'm just going to let you be there. I'm not going to give you the energy and attention that you're demanding me. And, you know, if we could just give it a shot and see what happens, I think we'd be surprised.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's really good advice. I completely agree. The whole idea of kind of letting go and letting it kind of wash over you almost. Because you feel like it's this tidal wave that's going to knock you down. And you never know. You know, there's no certainty. Maybe it will knock you down. I doubt it. But the tidal wave's coming at you. You feel it's going to knock you over and kill you. But actually what you realize is when you drop your guard, it's almost imaginary, the wave. And it just passes you without you even noticing it. And that's why, like, I've always been drawn to Zen Buddhism. Not from a religious point of view. In no way am I a Buddhist, but I love the philosophy of Zen Buddhism, and so many of the teachings have always taught about just letting go, just accepting as it is the experience. Today I still read those types of books because I find them so useful for recovery and general mental health. And I guess on that note, you know, you mentioned about mindfulness at the beginning. Are there any kind of mindfulness practices that you do or you teach that you think could benefit?
Sure. So one that I really do like, and this is actually something that I've borrowed and used in my treatment from the happiness trap, is this concept of unhooking. And it can be done in sort of a meditative state. You can sort of get yourself in a meditative state and practice this. But it's a bit of, you know, watching your thoughts, watching your sort of the thoughts pass by, and really asking ourselves, you know, are we going to hook on to them? And can we hook on to thought processes that are helpful versus thought processes that are unhelpful? And asking ourselves, okay, well, what is that? What's a helpful thought process? What's an unhelpful one? And I really think about it as helpful as any direction that takes you where you want to go, a thought that takes you in the direction you want to go. So if you want to have a, for example, a healthier relationship to your anxiety, right? Hooking on to thoughts of, you know, empowerment, hooking on to thoughts that encourage you to tolerate, going and doing something of value, that's going to be a really helpful direction. Whereas obviously getting stuck in sort of rumination and really giving into that urge to want to hold, that's going to be more unhelpful. That's going to take us further away from that goal. So for me, this is kind of a bit of a motivation or framing strategy, but oftentimes I will ask myself simply the question of, is where I'm at mentally right now helpful or is it unhelpful? In other words, is it leading me towards the Shiva that I want to be, you know, the version of myself that I'm creating in every moment, you know, or am I engaging in something that is, it's going to be causing me more distress?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's obviously values in ACT. Yeah, I love all that whole, just direct your attention towards your values. Isn't always going to work, but it's it kind of pushes you towards the life you want, and that's a huge part of recovery, right?
Absolutely. And just to emphasize the idea of practice, you know, that none of this is going to come. And it's certainly even for, and I'll just say for myself, it's something I still practice every day, every week. You know, it's a lifelong journey.
Absolutely. I mean, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about you become a better person almost because of it. And it's, you know, I doubt I ever would have focused on my values if I hadn't had to. Silver lining. And similar question to what I asked you a moment ago about what should someone start doing is, except for compulsions, obviously, what's the one thing people with OCD could stop doing?
Stop doing. Let me think about what my advice would be on that. Gosh, you know, my mind keeps coming back to resistance. It really does. It really comes back to this idea of how much resistance can create a power imbalance between ourselves and our anxiety. Gosh, let me think here. You know, I'll give a different angle on this, which is I do believe that we can stop really sort of, if it's possible, and I know this is so tough for people to do, but to sort of give themselves a break. This is going to be about compassion, I think, to A, recognize that what is happening, that thoughts, for example, are outside of our control, and that oftentimes what we ruminate on or obsess about actually says more about what we value and what we care about than anything about what we would do. For example, I think it's fascinating and no coincidence that so many of my clients who work with who have harm OCD are in the healthcare profession, or many of my clients with pedophile-related OCD, many of them are teachers. Many of them love children, you know, and to sort of give ourselves a break, let ourselves off the hook a little bit when it comes to judgment. I think that when we talk about helpful versus unhelpful, judgment is one of those experiences that it really is countertherapeutic. Of course, we understand why it's a confusing disorder. And oftentimes we're isolated and we don't have the benefit of being able to compare these thoughts with others and to know that we're not alone. But, you know, I think my message would just be to your listeners to, you know, imagine that if we can think it, we can obsess about it. You know, if the brain can think it, we can get caught in a rumination on it, and that is really no indication of your true belief system, your true value system. And that's one thing I think could could really, really increase our sort of journey towards recovery and certainly just our care of ourselves.
Yeah, I completely agree with that advice. Yeah, I agree what you're saying. It's kind of like, it's opposite your values almost. So like last night I was laying in bed, partly why I had a terrible night's sleep. I couldn't sleep because my mind was just racing. Various things, and it just keeps jumping. And one thing was, I haven't been able to commit to some volunteering that I promised I would do. Eventually I will be able to get back to it. Basically, my mind was then going, you know, I overpromise, I'm not delivering, I've let this person down, I've potentially caused damage, but my mind's running off on all these things. And I was feeling like a bad person. And then I thought, hang on a minute, it's because I care that shows that I'm a good person. Otherwise, I wouldn't, you know, a bad person wouldn't be worrying about that. So it was kind of like that realization was allowed me to kind of diffuse and then accept the uncertainty. And then sure enough, a couple of minutes later, it didn't even bother me. It's amazing how these thoughts can be so intense. The next minute, you're like, why was I even worrying? And obviously, an hour later, it might come back. But
absolutely. Just that shift in perspective, you know, just kind of looking at them from a different angle can really show us so much about their true power, you know, which is really not much at all.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like an empty threat. Okay, so you're in an elevator. In a building in LA somewhere, you've got 30 seconds in the elevator. Someone recognizes you from the podcast, and they say, "I have OCD. Do you have any advice for me?"
Oh, do I have any advice for you? Yeah, sure. I'd say, "Hello, how are you? We've got 30 seconds, so let's go. Let's kind of get into this." Gosh, I would say again, really, rather than fighting, rather than hating, rather than resisting, try doing nothing. Try sitting with, try allowing, try accepting, even if it feels like you're going to explode because the pain of it is so unbearable and it feels so wrong and it feels so counterintuitive. Try riding that wave and proving to yourself that you can, and proving to yourself that, you know, these thoughts and this experience is something that you can bear, that you can sit with. And the last thing I would say is poke some fun at it. You know, OCD is, it's not a laughing matter. And yet it is such a tool for us, I think, to see OCD sometimes for the ridiculousness that it is. It's of course, again, not to minimize the pain, but you know, sometimes when we look at it and we sort of see how silly it is, we can gain some perspective. So sometimes a good laugh at your thoughts, can be great medicine.
Absolutely. Okay, so this podcast is, for me anyway, recovery is about living an amazing life, whatever that is to each person, because each person has their own desires and wishes and needs. But what advice would you give kind of one human to another for that person to live their kind of best life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the idea here is, you know, can you continue living? Can you kind of get on? Can you continue to have a full life and allow for that to include OCD? And can we not look at it as, you know, I can't live fully until I solve this? Recognize that that can also be a trap of our anxiety, and, you know, do our best as individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder to live fully, even through treatment, through recovery, through management, to continue to go for what you want, to continue to, socialize, to continue to live the fullest life you can, and to, again, do so while managing, that both can happen and both should happen. In fact, it's necessary to our recovery to continue moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you got a billboard in downtown LA. You can write anything on that billboard. It doesn't have to be OCD related. What would you write on it?
I would write something along the lines of, you know, give up control. You never had any to start with anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. Control or certainty is just an illusion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I need that reminder quite a bit.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And then finally, is there anything else you'd like to share or say on the episode?
You know, just that it is, you know, increasingly, I think we're, you know, more and more people are discovering that they have an intrusive thinking and experiences with things that, you know, feel like OCD, like anxiety disorders. And again, just to sort of remind listeners and remind myself that we aren't alone in this, and that, you know, this is what's going on for us biologically, that it is, again, not an indicator of who we are. It's not an indicator of our worth, that it is sort of a mental glitch, you know, going on in our brains. And to be able to see it as such and separate it from who we are, from what we can accomplish, and recognize that management is a very attainable goal with obsessive compulsive disorder. And, you know, through seeking the right kind of help with a licensed specialist, that it's very, very much attainable.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good words of wisdom to end on. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed this. And obviously, thank you for the TED Talk as well. I'll put all the links in the show notes and stuff.
Absolutely. I really appreciate Stuart. And again, thank you so much for what you do for our community. And it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
So thanks, guys. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Shiva. And don't forget, today's episode was sponsored by the Gateway Institute, which have locations in Orange County, San Francisco, and Phoenix, Arizona. And if you're in one of those areas and looking for treatment, head over to gatewayocd.com. That's gatewayocd.com. All show notes and other links will be on the OCDstories.com/podcast. Thanks and take care, and I will speak to you soon.